Today, we're taking a journey into the unknown as we discuss recent UFO sightings and what it means to prepare for an actual alien invasion. As humans, our fascination with the possibility of extraterrestrial life has sparked countless debates and investigations. Recent UFO sightings have only intensified this curiosity. But what if these sightings were not merely a curiosity? What if one day, our world is faced with an extraterrestrial presence? It might sound like the stuff of science fiction, but today, we'll explore the real-world implications and even the fringe theories surrounding this possibility. While it is essential to approach these claims with skepticism, preparing for such an event can serve as a reminder of our resilience and adaptability as a species.
This has definitely been the hardest prepping episode I have ever had to brainstorm for, but I have actually came up with a few things which I think actually might be helpful, so I'm pretty excited.
To start off, what state do you think has the most UFO sightings?
I'm gonna say Oregon.
Oregon, okay. No.
Then Arizona. I mean, those are the two.
Not even close.
And those are the two that come to mind, you know.
What was the second one? Coast,
Arizona.
Arizona. Let's see where Arizona.
Phoenix has so many sightings.
Oh, I would say they had the biggest sighting.
But yeah, it's always, to me, it seems to be those places way out in the middle of the West. But, you know, not the very populated centers, except Phoenix. Phoenix seems to be just a hotspot. You don't hear about UFOs or, okay, UAPs in New York City.
Right, right.
Or LA or Houston. But you hear a lot of them in the Phoenix area. So, but normally, I think, like, the woods. You know, some guy getting a
Heavily wooded area. So I would have to say Oregon has 3,500 UFO sightings. That's a lot. Arizona has a little bit more. They have 4,900, okay, but that's still nothing compared to California.
Oh,
California has 16,084 sightings.
Whoa.
Yes.
That's probably three times as much as most other places.
That's a lot.
But, you know, it does make sense. I mean, California has a lot of woods, especially in the northern, northeast section.
These are sightings that have been reported, right? So there might be more in other places that just never get reported, but this one has the most reported UFO sightings. I picked out a few different ones, and now all of this data and these stories are coming from the National UFO Reporting Center.org by Peter Davenport, which I've talked about on the show before. It's been a while, so I wanted to give a bit of an update. There was some recent ones that I picked out, and this one occurred on the 8th, 22, 2023, so 2 months ago. This happened in Long Beach, California, and what they reported seeing was something like a fireball in the sky. Now, this lasted for about 8 minutes. Now, that is a long time. Now, this is what they had to say. They said they saw a fireball moving west to southeast in a horizontal direction at about 2:30 a.m., He said, I was going to my bathroom on the second floor. I looked out my window and saw a fireball with a trailing red and orange flames following from west to southeast. I thought it might be an aircraft with flaming engines or maybe some kind of space junk. I estimated my sight was 45 degrees horizontal plane. This object was moving in a horizontal direction for about 11 and a half minutes before the flames went out. After the flames went out, there was a small bright dot with a faint glow behind it that continued for 3 to 5 minutes, moving southeast. But after this, a lower orange ball of light appeared well below 10 degrees horizontal. That appeared to circle for about 30 seconds and then it disappeared completely. So yeah, these fireballs that keep being reported, there was even one reported in San Antonio, if you can believe it, a couple years ago. They're always very strange.
Yeah, but the fireball is a pretty common spotting. There's normally the moving lights, fireballs, and then like spotlights.
Yeah, but you can say, okay, moving lights, that's obviously some kind of craft moving, right? This is just a fireball.
Yeah.
What really is a fireball?
Well, I wonder, does it look more like a comet where it streaks and has a long tail and it doesn't really curl a lot? Because that could just be it moving very fast through the atmosphere.
So people have reported in the past when they see a fireball, it does resemble somewhat of a comet.
Okay. So I would assume that it's just them moving around and going.
Very strange.
Because how fast does something, when something's re-entering orbit, right? Like those old capsules from the Apollo program. They look like a big old fireball, right? So I would imagine that the same sort of thing would happen if you were going that same speed, but in any direction. Now, when we're exiting the atmosphere, we don't go that fast because there's no reason to be in such a hurry to get out of the atmosphere that fast. It burns up so much fuel. But if you're an alien and you have tons of power and being able to accelerate and decelerate and fly in any direction you want is totally a possibility with your power supply, then I don't see why going a little faster through the atmosphere and causing what looks to be, you know, that burning sensation of re-entry, but just do that in any other direction. Go that speed. And we know that they can move fast. They move abnormally fast. So it wouldn't be out of the possibility to me that that is one of the things. But I have another theory. Maybe it's a sensor of some kind or some other unmanned object that they're done with and they're destroying. Because that's one of that's what you're supposed to do with a satellite. When a satellite is no longer functioning, they push it into orbit and then they have it burn up on re-entry. So that way it's just totally gone. It's not flying around in outer space, possibly going to collide with something. And it doesn't
explode. That makes sense to me.
Into little pieces. So maybe it's an unmanned observation of some kind that they're done with. And they're just like, okay, self-destruct now. And instead of wasting a whole ton of self-destruct ordnance, putting that on some
right
thing, they just have it fly into the atmosphere and burn up.
Let's move on to the next one, because this is more of a traditional UFO report. Okay. So this happened on 8/31/2023. Again, about 2 months ago. Now this happened in Santa Cruz, California. It says it was around a forest area and the shape of it was a triangle. Lasted for about 1 minute. And the guy said that there were some odd characteristics, some typical ones that go with UFO reports, such as electrical or magnetic effects and missing time. So this is very much a classic UFO report. He starts off by saying, I am seeing weird things in the sky. I think there's a top secret thing going on at Lockheed property in the mountains. I was driving up Eagle Rock on a UTV, and I see this triangular object with rounded edges. It was in one spot, then jogged to another and hovered there for about 1 minute at a time. It rapidly flew over and descended behind the mountain range owned by Lockheed Martin. I panicked and ran behind a burnt out rock cliff / cave. When I realized there I was, it was the beginning of a sunset when I observed it. I knew I was there the whole time, but it seemed like sunset happened in 5 minutes while I was waiting for it to leave. Could not turn on the UTV until it left. It was jogging across the canyon, almost like it was surveying spots. So that was his report.
I think it is a little odd, though, in a few cases, is why would this alien be doing foot survey?
For the last UFO report that I have here, this happened on the 9/3/2023, so last month, at Walnut Creek, California. They say that the shape was star-like. The duration actually lasted for a minute as well. There were two people who saw this. Now, he said that this was a line of approximately 20 moving stars. I noticed a line of approximately 20 perfectly angled stars moving south to north over my house. They were at a very high altitude, similar to a satellite, but moving at a faster speed. I called my wife out of the house, and she also witnessed them. The transit lasted about 1 minute before going away. I have seen satellites passing overhead before, but nothing quite like this. And that was it. It's a very short report. I thought it was very interesting. 20 perfectly aligned moving stars. That is definitely something you don't see every day. And again, all three of these reports came out of California and different areas of California. And I know we have a huge California listener base. So yeah, I'm interested. If you guys want to email us about anything you've seen as strange in the sky, you can definitely send us an email. Even if you're not in California, tell me what you've seen in the sky. Very curious.
There's a few things that you've got to do. We have to do as like a thought experiment. That is, we have to make a few different assumptions about aliens. So I've been reading a bit about what different scientists have, you know, what do we know about aliens? If the UFOs or these unidentified aerial phenomenons, as they're called, or I haven't learned quite how to get it to roll off my tongue, but the UAPs. What can we gather from the aliens just if we assume that these are actual sightings of aliens? If we take the assumption that they work with the same laws of physics that we do, the majority of the people who do research on it have come to the conclusion that aliens have to be carnivores. And the reason for this is because of the way that evolutionary selection works, that the idea that something that is not carnivorous would develop in such a way that it would actually need to be more intelligent than its prey would be the only way that something would be able to evolve to the point where it can then start to form societies and start to do passed on knowledge, things like writing and teaching and starting to form cities and that sort of thing, and eventually evolve into the type of cultures that we would consider scientific. So the first assumption that we would want to make is that aliens are carnivorous. It's a fairly basic assumption, but it doesn't seem as though the main point of that is we can then assume a few things about their behavior. If they are descendant from carnivores and have societies, is that they've most likely then also gone through wars, just like our civilizations have, and they've also found a way to survive them. So odds are that they've probably invented nuclear bombs and biological weapons and not managed to wipe themselves out with it and gone to the point where they are able to travel through space. So the reason why this is an important aspect is, why would they come here based upon the world in which that they have evolved from?
Why would they come here?
Yeah. And one of the main reasons that people put forward is they would want to exterminate humanity before humanity becomes a threat. If you're looking across the galaxy and assuming that you're constrained to light still traveling at the speed of light to observe a planet, you could see that the planet, the Earth, has oxygen on it and therefore has life on it. That oxygen cannot survive in high quantities in a planet that does not have life, because oxygen reacts very quickly to a lot of different things in the universe. So if you have a high presence of oxygen, that means that oxygen must be continually being created. So if you're looking at the Earth, the first indication that there's life on Earth would be by gazing at the stars and then seeing something that's hundreds of light years away, or I guess more than hundreds, thousands of light years away, tens of thousands of light years away, and seeing that life is beginning to develop on this faraway planet. So you see that this life is starting to form, and that means that it started to form hundreds of millions of years ago, right? So that means that it currently is very advanced from the point at what you're looking at, because you're looking at the very far distant past. And if you look at how a life progression has happened on the planet, it has gone from there being, you know, microscopic organisms to there being multicellular things, and that took the majority 3 of the process. And then you have the main development until you have the five main animals starting evolving out. You have birds and lizards, birds, reptiles, mammals, fish, and amphibians. If you look at that as just a segment of when life started, it's the very tail end. And then if you subdivide that into when humans started coming into existence, then that's a very small sliver. And of the human history from like the past 10,000 years to the past 4,000 years. So we're talking about something that went a 6,000 year range that happened 4,000 years ago. A 6,000 range, a year range that happened 4,000 years ago. There wasn't much technological advancement as they moved from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. But then if you look at the last 4,000 years, excluding the last 100 years, there's been a huge industrial revolution and there's been a huge increase of capacity. But then you look at the last 100 years and we've gone from railroads and steam engines and small firearms and that sort of thing to in the last 100 years, going from that to planes and spaceships and computers and nukes, the amount of acceleration happens so quickly that if you're observing the planet from very far away, you have no idea what can just happen in a little blink of time in the eyes of the universe. I mean, what's going to happen in the next 10,000 years, which is a very minute amount of time. And in 10,000 years, if we continue growing at our planet at the same exponential rate, we will be absurdly advanced, right? So if you're observing this planet 100 million years ago, and you see that it has life on it, you know that you have a very small window to get there before they become technologically advanced enough that they surpass you, or at least maybe become your equal, or that sort of thing. So in that sense, this place that has had the same history of sorts as us, that has experienced wars and famines and all of these sort of things, are going to have the problem of, well, either we wipe them out or they could wipe us out. So in that sense, most experts on aliens assume that the first thing aliens are going to try to do is to make sure that we aren't threats to them. And that brings us to prepping, because if these aliens are at all concerned and they just want us to be destroyed, there's not a whole lot that we can do about it. Because the first assault that's most likely going to happen is they're going to abduct people, figure out how to kill them biologically, then release some sort of biological weapon against the world's population and wipe out humanity, and then move in. So why even have a fight when you can have a virus do it for you? So in that case, if there is an alien attack and you manage to survive, the thing that you ought to prep to do is the possum scenario. You play dead, because if the aliens ever figure out that they didn't get everyone, you don't stand a chance if they're advanced enough to wipe us out like that. Because there's, you know, a few variations of how powerful they would be. And if they're powerful enough to wipe us out without us ever being able to actually prove that they even have visited us once, then you're not going to want to engage with them in any sort of actual conflict. Play possum. That's the first stage. Now, if they decide that they just want to keep us from becoming a threat, an alien invasion may look like aliens coming in and just taking over and setting up governments, alien-run governments, that are to subject humanity to not rising up and destroying them entirely. So they would have a mix of benevolence and a mix of subjugation is what that would look like. And in that case, the most important thing that you can do is to become indispensable in value to them. So you've got to think of this as, what do you do if your country gets colonized? And I was thinking of this from the lens of what I can understand as, you know, we know what colonialism is from when it's happened on our planet before. So you do the same preparation that somebody in a tribe, an old indigenous tribe, would do if you're being colonized. What is the best thing that you can possibly do? And viewing different cultures and how they responded and which ones came out the best, there's not a whole lot that came out amazingly, but I'd say that some of the best, I would say, was India, actually. India or China came out on top pretty good. you know, Hong Kong, both of those were British colonies. And India worked, there's a few different ways that you've got to do a bit of cooperation, but not be threatening at the same time. So one of the main things that you've got to do is learn the language, and most importantly, learn their judicial system. Is the first thing that you've got to understand is how does their legal system work? Because if you look at how North America was settled by the Americans and the Canadians, and to an extent Mexico, but I guess we'll just leave Mexico out of this discussion for a bit, just to focus on this one particular thing, is one of the main things that the North American tribes had an issue with is getting lasting treaties, because they were not able to leverage the court system in the U.S. There was the problem of what do you do when the treaty is broken? How do you take the Americans to court? And that would be a hard thing to go back in history to fix. What would be the main thing that you would need to change? And one would be to have material value to barter with. One of the main things that the Native Americans had an issue with was the only thing that they could barter with was land. So they didn't have a very strong strategic standing. And when people came and stole their land, you know, came and moved in, started setting up fences and that sort of thing, they couldn't get a try in the courts. So that was just all around lose-lose situation. But if you look at India and China, the companies that were set up there did have some sway in the courts. So I would say if you have aliens coming in as your overlords, the first thing you've got to do is learn the language, or else you're not going to be able to communicate well, and you're not going to be able to learn. But once you're able to learn what the aliens teach, you've got to then adopt their legal system and try and gain influence and power inside of their courts. Not necessarily their political system, but inside of the judicial system. So that way you can find a way that you can have binding contracts between you and the aliens. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. But, you know, learning an alien language, it's got to be difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even think our vocal cords make the same sounds.
No, but you could maybe learn how to read and write.
That is true.
Because the main thing you want to do is not to be able to speak the language, but to be able to tap into their knowledge.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, aliens don't really speak. Every time we hear a story about an alien being that's trying to communicate with a human, it's always telepathically. Right. So what if we had to learn how to telepathically communicate with other people?
That might be still impossible, but I'm assuming that there would still be a medium of which you could communicate somehow, some way.
Right.
There's still probably going to always be a written communication. I can't imagine the aliens exist without written communication, or at least digital communication. So you might have to learn how to code an alien. So that way you can change basic text into alien language through computers and send the court's emails that they can understand. But also, I mean, think about it. If you can't speak at all, you don't have vocal cords, you could still go to court with a translator who does sign language.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to just walk up to an alien, give them a Reese's, a sign of peace, and I think we'll be all right.
I think that that's a good point there. You would do well to have friends. So the Native Americans did much better under colonization in Canada than they did in the United States of America. And the reason for that is the Canadians integrated much deeper with the Indians, and there was a whole lot more communities that were built half and half. So that would be a good thing to try, Eric, is try to make friends with an alien, get them interested in something that humans do, like Reese's, or I don't know, maybe you could get one of them hooked on Fortnite or something. Maybe they would find that interesting. But if not, you would want to do the reverse and try and develop a taste for alien Reese's and alien Fortnite. But here's the thing. You would want to somehow find... You would be working from a position of... A position of weakness, a position of asymmetrical domination. You can't do outright Independence Day combat. It's not going to work. And I don't even think guerrilla tactics would work.
Yeah, so we would lose.
So you've got to do some sort of if you can't beat them, you join them. sort of a thing.
Right.
So you've got to find what they value that you can then somehow either be valuable or tech into to be valuable.
There's a movie that kind of goes along with what you're saying, and it's called District 9. Have you ever seen it?
No.
It's kind of like a documentary style movie. It's an actual movie though, but they kind of set it up kind of like The Office, where they have like set up fake interviews and stuff. But they have the aliens had, I guess, invaded already, but at some point they have integrated with humans. And so we have this society where aliens and humans coexist and they work together, the office, and it's kind of an interesting take.
Yeah, that would be best case scenario. But secondly, a secondary to that would be the Japanese approach. Because if, you know, I've been pointing at different colonizing groups. When was Japan ever colonized?
You got me on that. I don't know.
It really wasn't. So I guess it's a bit of a trick question. But Japan didn't have a whole lot of natural resources. And it still is considered a natural resource poor island. So that's a bit difficult for Japan. And they're a massive resource importer. But let's say the aliens don't want anything to do with you. And you have to stay separated from them. One of the things that Japan did that allowed itself to be propelled into a world economy that is today a leader in several areas is the whole culture came together to try and industrialize and to become modern, not to be left behind. There was a very determined push to modernize as fast as possible. And in something like 20 years, they did what took England over 100 years when it comes to going through the industrialization. And they were able to catch up from like 1880 to 1920 in that period, completely catch up with the West or something like that. It was a huge amount of... But the point is, the amount of effort was done on a national level. It wasn't one person doing everything by themselves. It was the whole country essentially kicking into overdrive to become a powerhouse. So that would be a secondary group. If you can't integrate directly with the aliens, but you have the ability, is try and some way catch up with the aliens, but not to become a threat, because that didn't work out for Japan, but to try and
become, I get what you're saying,
a country of value and trade that Japan is. Japan is a very valuable trading partner. So you want to become that as fast as possible. So conquest, trade, resource extraction, that might be another one. If they want to mine the earth and they want to use the human population to do it, because if they don't want the human population to mine the earth and they try to exterminate the human population first, please refer back to the possum strategy mentioned earlier. But if they do want to use the human population to do the extraction, how would you think about throwing your fellow man under the bus for your own good, Eric? How would that, like, if it's a, well, we're all going into the mines, how do I leverage my position in regards to the best that I can get, regardless of what happens to everyone else?
Is this a every man for himself scenario?
Yeah, well, maybe. Would you, in that situation, think that that would be a terrible thing to do at any time? Would that be morally wrong? To go, you know what? It's every man for himself at this point. I'm not going to work together with everyone else. I'm going to try and get into some cushy janitor position.
No one has ever successfully banded together against an opposing huge threat, right? It's never been the case. People always try to outthrow everybody else or the leader in position because they think they can do it better. And they always get a small group to rally behind them as well. But would I go so far as to say I'm just gonna be in it for me? And I don't think I can do that personally. What I mean when I say that is I don't think I have the skills to do it on my own. So I wouldn't even try to do it.
Well, maybe you wouldn't need skills. Because what I'm thinking is, if you're being used as labor, it's kind of like the aliens, who we are assuming are more intelligent, more evolved and advanced than us. They see us as like a bunch of cattle that they're using to pull carts with. would you be the person who would go, okay, instead of being their cow, I'm going to try and be their lap dog and try and be the little poodle that lives inside? Not because I'm good at anything particular, but just because they find me amusing.
I do not think I could be subservient, so no.
Well, I mean, have you ever met a dog that wasn't very subservient and kind of acted like it was a prince or a princess and was very rude to the owner, and the owner just bended to its every whim and desire?
I mean, I'm sure there are dogs like that, but I have not come across one, no.
Ah, okay. Well, prepping that you can do in that situation is, if you're the listener, is consider to yourself where your moral lines are. Are you the kind of person who's like, yeah, when it comes comes to shove, I'm going to try and just be the person who reads the situation as, can we win this together, or is this a we lose, so I'm going to try and throw everyone else under the bus if necessary, even if that means becoming a traitor, a turncoat, insider? And that's the sort of thing that you would want to determine now instead of trying to figure it out on the fly. Band together, maybe we win if we band together. We don't know. I mean, we stand a chance. And then you were like, you know what, I'm going to be the Judas here and be the guy who tells you out. In that case, I might be like, boy, that was
a low blow.
Yeah.
Just for your 30 pieces of silver.
Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe the aliens have really good chicken nuggets or something. I don't know.
I don't know if I would be a Judas, but maybe I could be a Brutus.
I guess that makes sense. Because Brutus believed that he was doing the right thing.
Exactly.
And then the Brutus was like, well, I guess the average Roman civilian must really want me to assassinate Caesar. This one's more fun. So I think it'd be a good one to close out with. There is a possibility that the aliens that come and visit aren't part of the alien government. They're just really rich aliens out on vacation.
You know, I've heard that theory before, and I think I've heard it from you.
So if there's a bunch of aliens who are just coming and visiting for the sake of exploration, and they've got their little TikToks or whatever. So if you've got like a super rich kid who's shown up with his little space yacht, and he's got all of his indentured servants, aliens. In that case, I could see a situation where you could actually get away with being able to fight at disparity with this alien outsider because they have no backup. But the issue with that would be if you have this alien brat who's, you know, thinking that it's fun to shoot the local wildlife and seeing how many he can rack up before he has to go home. You have this issue of, if I was to shoot the brat, is the brat's dad going to come and do an extermination? Or if he just sees you as wildlife? Like, if you're a super rich guy, right? And your kid goes off on a yacht cruise and he gets killed, mauled by a lion that he was hunting. Are you going to want to be petty enough to go hunt down that lion just for revenge?
I think most people would, yeah.
Even if you consider that lion to be a dumb animal.
Mm.
Because there's some people who might hear the news, oh, your son was eaten by a lion while he was out hunting, be like, oh, that's terrible, and just go into mourning and never really give two thoughts about the lion. But then there might be somebody who feels like, well, it's my duty to go kill that man-eating tiger. So in that case, what do you do with aliens that are being violent but aren't doing a world takeover? What would be the government response to that? And what would be your response to the government response?
I think we know what the government response would be.
Yeah, it'd be very strong, decisive, what do they call it, violence of action. But if you are on the front lines, okay, the government's like, we are going to mobilize the entire U.S. military to take down Mr. Alien Jr., the lesser. And you are going to be space cowboy number 10,032, right? You're just some conscripted grunt with no training. And you're like, okay, we're going to send you in wave assaults and we're going to sit back and analyze how you're destroyed so we can better form an attack against this alien vacationer. This is a really absurd scenario. What would you do in that situation, Eric? Would you die for the greater good of humanity?
Of course not.
And that's a hard spot to be in. But I think that there would be a lot of people who would do it. they wouldn't be happy about it, and they would, but still mindlessly march to their
end. I could see that. Yeah, I could see that. Bit of a martyr.
Not even a martyr. Just somebody who feels like they're being driven into a concentration camp, but feel like they have no other choice. Just the despair.
That's a tough one.
Here's the thing. After the meat waves go grinding down the alien, and then you capture the alien spaceship, and then you backwards technologically engineer it. So then that way you can then assault alien that come to back up to kill the tiger. So it's like, oh, your son was killed by a lion while out hunting in the African outback. There is another one, though, that might be even more desperate, I would think. Because one of the other things aliens might do when they're coming is maybe their own planet has become unstable and inhospitable for life, and they have to go find a new home. So all of them board up on their Elon Musk savior spaceships, and they all go flying out into space, not even knowing where they're going. They're going through space and trying to synthesize food and greenhouses on board and try and make this biosphere that's self-sustaining as they travel through space and dodge asteroids and try and keep their engines running as they look for like a new home. And then they stumble across the Earth, and it doesn't look like a tactical invasion. It's more of a, we just kind of plopped here and we didn't even want to be here, but now we're stuck in a life and death struggle, all out fight, where the aliens have come from a place where they can't go back. They weren't prepared for a war. Then they get thrust straight into one. And then you start having something that looks more like Independence Day. That was an absurd one that I was thinking of. Because, like, this would be a group of aliens who aren't as technologically advanced as, like, warp back and forth across space. These are the guys who were doing, like, slow crawl across space, and this is, like, the eighth generation that have never been on their home planet. And they've have limited resources, and they've been fighting to stay alive as they've traveled through space. In that situation, I think that there is, the idea is backwards to every other prepping scenario I've come up with. As in every prepping scenario that I've ever thought of, it's always been from the how do I take care of me to survive till the end, right? How do I have enough food for me? How do I have enough water for me? How do I eventually survive in the end till I can find some other point of stability? This one is different because the best thing that you can do is what most preppers don't like. And that is you have to go and work with the government and do everything that you are told to do, because your only chance of survival is to do a kind of like a wartime economy. Like, you've got to put everything in the entire country into rationing. All the access luxuries get turned into war materials. As many people get turned into soldiers as fast as possible and pumped out onto the front lines. That is your best case scenario for survival. And that is like totally opposite to everything that is prepping, you know?
I don't like it.
There's never in prepping this is the only time where I've ever seen the what you must do is band together with the government and join the army.
Yeah, I don't like it. That will conclude today's episode. Thank you so much for listening to Bizarre Conspiracies. If you want to email me or Conrad, you can do so at bizarreconspiracies@gmail.com. That is all one word, bizarreconspiracies@gmail.com. Any final conclusions, Conrad?
The main thing is try and figure out what the aliens want, and then try and find a mutually beneficial end as fast as possible. If they want to harvest your organs for science, but they say they'll put them right back and you'll be just fine, it might be best to trust them, even though you have no guarantee that they're actually being honest with you, because the odds of winning a fight are very low. So find out what they want. See if you can both have what you want in a mutually beneficial way first, and then secondly, try and find the most comfortable and painless way to die.
Once again, thank you for listening, and as always, we will catch you in the next episode.